Hello everybody and welcome to the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike, where we are working through a rewatch of the 1990s TV show Twin Peaks. I am Mike and with me as always is Hannah. How are you this evening, Hannah?
Happy non-denominational holiday to everybody.
Yes, happy weird bit between Christmas Day and
New Year's. Christmas gooch.
Yes, the sweet spot, the Goldilocks zone, if you will. How are you this evening, Hannah?
I am well. I'm ready to talk all things Twin Peaks.
Excellent stuff. Well, I mean, you say all things Twin Peaks, but very specifically, the fourth episode of season two. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this episode, Hannah?
It is called Laura's Secret Diary and aired on the 20th of October, 1990. Synopsis says, Leland confesses to killing Jacques Renault. Andy wants to take a new sperm count test. Rumour spreads that a food critic is coming to Twin Peaks. Jean asks Ben to set a trap for Cooper in exchange for Audrey's life.
The cad.
The cad indeed. Sorry, I forgot to tell you who it was directed by.
And written by.
It is directed by Todd Holland.
Yep.
And written by, okay, let me take a breath, Mark Frost, Jerry Stahl, Harley Payton, Robert Ingalls.
Okay.
Gosh, quite the group.
They did. Got passed around like a bong, this one did, didn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah, it's funny. I'll get to it when we talk about the episode proper, but there's some interesting behind-the-scenes shenanigans involved in this episode as well, which I learned about from reading the Ratty and Plastic fanzine in my sad little bedroom in the early 90s.
Built into the window.
Yeah. I would get them delivered to me from America. So
looking out on your silent little street, cul-de-sac, the snow coming down.
No, this was actually a house that I shared with some friends in a really rough part of Birmingham. It wasn't quite as idyllic as that, but it's funny how a lot of my Twin Peaks memories are, you know, because there's that initial watch of the show, you know, when it was on and it was a cultural phenomena and all that. But then there's it was funny because I should probably save this for the show, but I never kind of left the show. It wasn't one of those ones that I watched and enjoyed at the time and then rediscovered a few years later. Mm. I just continued watching it. For me it was a cult show since day one, but I do think about how, you know, it was on TV and, you know, I managed to find somebody who'd recorded them all, so I got them all, and then they were released on sell-through video to buy. Mm. Quite a while after the show, actually. Wasn't until about 1994.
Is that when you got two episodes per tape?
Yeah. Mm. And that was when I kind of became like a recruiter for Twin Peaks. That was when I remember my friend Barney showing it all to him and rewatching it all with him. And then I took
Tell you about the good Lord David Lynch.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I took the videos. I didn't take him. I didn't take Barney to university with me. That would have been weird. I took the videos with me to university and then I converted loads of people there. Although I was doing a film studies degree, so it was a pretty easy sell, as I'm sure you can imagine. So it's funny, I've got, you know, the memories of the show being on and it being this current contemporary big thing. And then I've got my memories of it a few years later when I was really, you know, digging for all the information that I could in that pre-internet age.
Yeah.
And then the internet did come along and then that opened up a whole other world of fandom as well. So it's funny I do think about that. But we'll plenty to talk about there. Mm-hmm. A couple of quick bits of housekeeping before we get into it. Have we got any feedback?
We do have one just very minor little bit of feedback.
Well, it is that weird bit between Christmas and the New Year, isn't it? For which there is no name. Apart from, you know, the one you just gave it.
I can't take credit for it. I heard Ramesh Ranganathan say it and I just thought, yeah, it is.
I'm sure that Paul and I made that joke years ago.
Oh, well.
About it being the Gooch of the Year. But anyway, maybe it's just one of those.
He wasn't saying it in like a comedy routine. He just said it.
Yeah, well, neither were we. We're not. Back in Paul and mine's 2008 tour.
No, I'm not saying he's the one who coined it. I heard him say it.
Maybe it's just, I think some ideas are just so perfect that multiple people get to them at the same time. But a quick little bit of housekeeping before we get on to things. A reminder that we do appreciate feedback. It is a fine motivator for podcasts to know that we're not just screaming out into the abyss. I can see that people are listening and downloading the show, but it would be good to know who you are and if you have any thoughts or contributions you would like to make. I have a feeling that we'll start to get a lot more feedback when we reach the third season.
Yeah.
Because I feel like Twin Peaks has been pretty well covered.
Yeah.
But I don't think that Twin Peaks The Return has. It's still fresh enough that I don't think... There were people who covered it when it was on at the time.
But perhaps not like a retrospective
Yeah,
look.
Going back and looking at it, I think that that might be... Yeah, I suspect we'll get a little bit of conversation going there. But that is rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. Or if you listen to us on YouTube, you can leave us comments there. I'll mention to you, Hannah, actually, because you probably wouldn't have noticed, not that you would have. But what I've actually started doing with the YouTube version is I've actually been making them almost like videos where I managed to source... That a Laserdisc rip of, you know how I said that they put out all of the location footage of Twin Peaks, just for shots of the roads and the trees on Laserdisc, like in the 90s. I managed to get a rip of that. So what I do is I put the audio over that. Mm. So if people are listening to it on YouTube, there's images and video there as
well.
Nice. So it's not just, they're not just looking at a still image there. And I'll probably do that for all of our shows moving forward, because although we're not a video podcast, it'd be nice to sort of zhuzh it up a little bit for the video people. So for the last couple of episodes, I've been doing that as well. So you can actually have it on your TV if you want to.
Cool.
And it makes it a little bit more sense that way. But what I will mention again, I mentioned this the other week, but it's something that I want to get in the habit of remarking on, is, you know, we are also an audio podcast. So if you look on Spotify or iHeartRadio, or what I didn't realise was, I'll have to check for us, is... Do you know, and I've got no idea where this came from, Chinstroker versus Punter has since it became a video series, it's got an IMDb page.
Really?
And like episode guide, like a show. I've got no idea where that came from. It's the weirdest thing. Because it's like web series, and it says started, and it's got a random date. And I looked, and it was when we started putting videos up.
Oh, yeah.
And then you click on episodes.
Since you've done 28 episodes.
Yeah, but they're the ones that we've actually done videos for on YouTube. I just thought, I wonder if like Cheesecake vs. Spencer has been mentioned by anyone on IMDb, because you can do searches for conversations.
Yeah.
And then it was like show, and I'm like, has somebody ripped us off? And then I was like, that's us.
It's so weird.
I haven't checked for the Rewatch Project, but but we don't do video, so I don't know whether that would count. But yeah, that's just so bizarre. So you can leave us comments on YouTube. Also, we appreciate reviews.
I typed in Rewatch Project, and what came out first was the Bear Witch Project.
Wow.
Pretty sure we're not there.
search the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. I think you might get more luck. But
maybe put the...
But I don't think we are, because we haven't done videos. But we do appreciate reviews, preferably positive ones, on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. And also check out our friend shows, namely Chinstroker versus Punter, his film, Her Movie, The Good, the Bad and the Odd, The Talk Without Rhythm Podcast, Video Game Landfill, and Film Bastards. And we are also on Instagram and Twitter, where in both cases we are at Rewatch Project.
I put in the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike, and the only result that came up was episode 96 of Between the Beaches podcast, called Processing Hyacinths and Pressing Ahead for Florida, an update on the Aquacultural Project with Nick Szabo and Mike Graves of Aquaculture.
Wow.
And Mike Elfenbein, conservation chair for the Cyprus chapter of the Isaac Walton League.
Wow, well, that's 20 seconds of my life I won't get back. We're not a video, We're not just a movie. We're not a TV series. It is what it is. But I noticed that when I was mowing the lawn yesterday and forgot to mention it. So I'll have to let Paul know, actually. So we're going to hit pause. We're going to watch fourth episode of season two of Twin Peaks. And I am forgetting something here, Alan. What is it?
Yeah, I've got just a tiny, tiny little bit of feedback.
Oh, yes. Please do go.
I wouldn't normally put this as a feedback, but I was so pleased to see who it was from. We had a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from our special friend, Silver Surfer. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, sending you love and good energy.
Awesome.
That's so lovely to hear from you, and I hope you are listening and enjoying.
Yes.
Please get in touch.
Yeah, let us know if you are well and still out there. But,
yeah, absolutely. Also, Jack Dubs, if you're around, please get in touch. I really miss hearing your, seeing your feedback.
Yes, it's good to have those regulars, isn't it? Mm. But cool. Okay, well, we're going to hit pause. We're going to watch an episode of Twin Peaks, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about it.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies. Oh, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
And we are back. So we have just hit stop on the fourth episode of season two of Twin Peaks. So before we get into the episode breakdown, any initial thoughts, Hannah?
I thought there was some amazing writing in this episode, and I'm interested to hear, you know, what the scenario was with the fact that there's four writers, but you know, usually when you see that many writers on a script, it's a bit all over the place. Mm-hmm. But I especially thought Ray Wise's monologue at the start,
yes,
and the judge's monologue.
It felt very Major Briggs.
They were both just beautiful,
yeah,
and so well delivered,
yeah.
Yeah, well, like what is the story around the writing?
Well, basically what you'll notice that it says that it's written by Jerry Stahl.
Yeah.
And then there's a bunch of the staff writers on the show. Now, Jerry Stahl was a pretty well respected, very hip at the time, novelist. And he was one of those people a bit like, I can't remember the guy's name now. He came from that group of people like Bret Easton Ellis, who wrote American Psycho and a bunch of other films.
Rules of Attraction,
yeah. And also, I can't remember the guy's name now.
Chuck Palahniuk.
Yeah, the guy who wrote Fight Club. Mm. He was part of that crew. And
his best book, I think, is Invisible Monsters, if anyone's read it.
Okay, I ain't much of a reader. You know, I was thinking of the Bill Hicks thing about the waitress. What you reading for? Like, not what you're reading, what you're reading for. I'll get to his books in a moment, but he was hired to write this episode. But he was deep in the midst of serious heroin addiction.
Right.
And he handed the script in, and Mark Frost said that it was just completely unusable.
Mm.
He said it was just all over the place. It showed a complete lack of coherence or understanding of the show. He'd obviously not read the show Bible.
Mm.
And he said there was blood all over the script when he got it as well. And I'm getting all this information. There's this really amazing book called Reflections, which is basically the book written about Twin Peaks.
Mm.
And Mark Frost says that he hated Jerry Stahl. He said Jerry Stahl was impossible to deal with. He said I don't think they even knew at the time the seriousness of his addiction.
Mm.
But he said that what happened was basically they salvaged it.
Mm.
They got Robert Engels and Harley Payton, who are the two kind of workhorse writers on the show, and Mark Frost, and they just fixed it. And they said that afterwards, Jerry Starr, and they said basically they saved his ass and they still gave him credit. And Mark Frost, who's a really mellow guy, said that Jerry Starr is the only person he's ever worked with in the industry who he wanted to physically assault.
Wow.
He said, I wanted to punch him. And he's like, and I am not the kind of guy who says that. Because he said that Jerry Starr afterwards talked loads of shit about them. And were like, oh, they rewrote me and all that. And he was, and Mark Frost was just like, dude, like we saved your ass. We made sure you still got paid. Mm. We gave you credit. We didn't tell anyone about any of this. And then you like go and talk shit about us afterwards.
Yeah.
And Mark Frost now, he's like, well, you know, obviously now I understand the full context. Mm. But, you know, it was still really difficult.
Still pisses you off.
But the thing that's really fascinating is that Jerry Starr, right after Twin Peaks, and I think he was in recovery at this point, wrote a book and a screenplay, became a movie called Permanent Midnight, starring Ben Stiller in a rare straight dramatic role. But that's an autobiographical film, and it covers that whole thing.
Oh, right.
So it's really, I remember hearing about all of this and seeing this film, Permanent Midnight, and it was all fictionalized. And he's like, he's, you know, a drug addict and obviously, and I'm watching, there's a bit of the film, I'm like, oh shit, that's Twin Peaks.
Mm.
But they've obviously, like I say, they've fictionalized it.
Mm.
But it's the only episode of the show that he ever worked on. But he did
Has he ever responded to Mark Frost's?
I'm not sure. I mean, all of this is based on what I know from the book Reflections, which was written probably 15 years ago. So I'd be curious to go back to it. But I know that Jerry Starr has gone on to write a lot more stuff. And I think he must have got his life together because, I mean, this was, you know, 30 years ago. And you don't have a heroin addiction for 30 years, you know.
Well, you don't have a heroin addiction for 30 years and still...
Well, okay, let me... Sorry, let me rephrase that. You don't have a... Well, I don't even know what the term is.
An active
heroin addiction for that. But so what that resulted in is them having to piece it together. But I agree with you. I think that for the most part, the episode holds together. What I will say, though, and I don't say this as a criticism, but I know that it could sound like this, is I think that this is by far the most straight-ahead TV episode of the series so far.
Very much
it feels like an episode of a TV show called Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
You know, and there's still moments that are unique. And all episodes, I mean, I'm saying this now. At the time, it was still very like, wow.
Mm.
But at the same time, I don't think that is necessarily a side effect of all of the complexities that were going on behind the scenes.
Mm.
I think it's just that we're at a point in the season where we need shit to happen.
Yeah, it is a straight through drama episode.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, and it's very. There's a couple of exceptions which we will mention, but it is very traditionally staged. It's lots of people in close up talking to each other, and you know, there's a couple of flourishes. But I think that the thing that saves this episode, aside from just the fact that it's a well cast show and it's well produced, is exactly what you said: is the writing, is the fact that. Okay, they had to kind of cobble it together, but it was an incredibly top of their game, talented group of writers.
If you're going to want anyone to cobble something together, you want those three writers doing it.
Yeah,
yeah. And Ray Wise, honestly, I mean, his best is yet to come in terms of performance.
Yeah, that guy's face, stuff he can do with his face.
Just the way he manages to have tears rolling down his face almost without realizing that they're coming out of him. Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's get into it because I mean, that's the opening scene. I mean, we open up with one of the more, the rare for this episode, Lynchian touches where we're kind of, we don't even know what we're looking at the beginning of the episode. We're moving through what looks like a tunnel of some kind. It
looks like rope at one point.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like the inside of a fiber or something under intense microscopic amplification, and you're hearing sounds and torment. And what we realize is we're coming through one of the minuscule holes in the sort of polystyrene ceiling tiles. But I think that what we're seeing is we're moving actually through Leland's psyche.
Yeah.
You know, we're traveling through because he's just off with the fairies. And you see him kind of snap out of it into the scene. And I think that what we see is kind of a visual representation of him returning to to reality.
Yeah.
And the scene itself, I mean, the combination of the dialogue and the performance. And I like the way that he says, you know, they're saying to him, you know, did you kill him? And he says, you know, have you ever felt loss?
Mm.
And Cooper says,
absolute loss.
Well, he comes back to that because Cooper says, I don't think any of us are strangers to grief. And he's like, I'm not talking about grief. I'm talking about absolute loss.
Mm.
And the way he describes it, and I think this is one of those different watching it as a parent.
Mm.
Because when you're a parent, you can't help but once in a while run these dark scenarios through your head and think about
intrusive thoughts about what if your child dies before you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And he talks about how it's like every molecule screams, and he talks about how it's like a noise, like it's a noise you can't switch off.
Yeah.
And that I've never experienced that, and obviously hopefully never will, but that seems real.
I mean, I haven't experienced that either, and touch wood, never will. But I know how I feel if I've had a couple of days away from our kids. Like,
I found one of your benders.
When I went up to stay with my folks for a couple of nights, I honestly felt like my limbs were missing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you know, they're so...
It's like a psychic connection, isn't it, almost?
Well, they're so integral to you. They are you.
Yeah.
You know, so it's yeah, it's pretty heart-wrenching to ever think of them hurt, let alone gone.
But I love the way that Ray Wise plays it as well, because the way he corrects Cooper, it's almost like he's being kind of intellectual about it as well as being emotional, because when Cooper mentions grief, he's like, no, it's more than that. You know, it's like he's kind of exploring it a little bit as well.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, and I love the way he's like, yes, I killed him. Yeah, and he kind of repeats it several times. Mm. And I think it's interesting that Cooper's not having any of it. Like afterwards, when Doc Hayward says something about, oh, you know, the poor guy, Cooper's like, are you... You know,
you condoning murder.
And I think what it is that Cooper is empathetic and he's caring, but ultimately his primary drive is justice.
Yeah.
And that kind of overrides everything. You know, he talks about how, I can't remember if this is in the show or if this is just in one of the books, like the secret, the audio book, the audio tapes of Agent Cooper.
Mm.
But he talks about how when he was a child, he had a poster of the FBI story, the Jimmy Stewart film, on his wall.
Mm.
And there's a great bit in season three when he's in the character of, spoiler alert, of Dougie, and he can't remember who he is, and he sees a statue of a lawman, of an FBI man. Yeah. And he's just, the whole of the end credits is just him staring at it, and you can tell that he can't remember why, but it has some intrinsic pull on him.
Yeah.
And that's Cooper's soul, is that Cooper loves people and loves, he's essentialist before, but ultimately his religion is justice, you know. So he looks uncomfortable in that scene, and I think it's because he's conflicted.
Mm.
I think it's because those two parts of his personality are, and I think maybe he's protesting too much.
Well, perhaps he's not been in that situation where he can see it from both sides before.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Because at this stage, he doesn't know anything else about anything else.
He's a sort of compartmentalizer.
Mm.
We see Doc Hayward and Andy have a conversation, and then there's a bit of tomfoolery around a sperm test.
I did love all that. I love Andy. I think he's great.
I think all the stuff with Andy, all the stuff with Dick Tremaine and Lucy, and all the stuff with, like, the food critic, that's very season two Twin Peaks.
And it's quite well done. Like Dick Tremaine is a fucking idiot.
He is.
But I like it is light relief.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, just yeah.
Well, Andy was trying to get a bit of light relief, wasn't he?
Well, wasn't he, Jess?
But he got interrupted. I love the way that the employee, the receptionist at the Great Northern, is telling Ben Horn about MT Wentz, and I love the way that you learn quite a lot about the Ben Horn's character in this episode. I think because you see him, he is bolstering her up, and he's being nice to her, and she's excitedly telling him, trying to score points with the boss, you know, and he's like, you know, oh, it's not even 9:30, and you've already earned your money, and she sort of walks away excitedly, and the second she's gone, his face just drops.
Yeah,
it's like he can't even be bothered to keep up the facade for a second longer than he has to.
He does not care.
He just doesn't give a shit, does he?
He does not give a shit.
And we see... The other thing about this episode as well that's interesting, and I think this is definitely a rewrite thing, is how many of the characters of the show aren't in it. Like, there's no James or Bobby or Major Briggs or Shelley. They're just the ones that spring to mind. It's like there's a whole... Probably half the cast.
Ed.
Yeah. Nadine. Yeah. And I think that the storyline needed to do certain things at this point anyway. But I think that when you're trying to do a redraft of something, you have to kind of boil things down to their absolute core.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we see Jean Reno go to see Ben, and he shows him the video. And there's lots of great little delicious bits of dialogue here as well. When Jean Reno lays it all out, and it talks about how he's representing some other people, but he wants Cooper. And I love the way that Ben's like, well, they should bear the cost of their middleman then. You know, he looks at it from like a businessman point of view.
Very much so.
When Jean Reno lays it all out for Ben, I think it's interesting that when he leaves the room, Ben like flips a table or a chair. And it's the first time you ever see Ben lose control.
And I don't think it's got anything to do with Audrey. I think it's the fact that someone's got one over on him, and he didn't see it coming.
Yeah, exactly. And it's we talked in the last episode, and you see a bit of that again in his interaction with Cooper about how he has to control every situation. It's not even about winning; it's about control. And the fact that this is now a situation where that he isn't commanding.
Yeah.
He loses it, and I think that that's an interesting thing considering, you know, where Ben goes in the upcoming episodes, that this is the first sign of things starting to crack.
Yeah.
You know, cracks starting to show a little bit there. We see Hank in the diner with Norma getting excited about NT Wentz, and you see that Norma's starting to kind of buy into it a little bit.
Well, I think
she wants to believe almost.
I think also having seen Ed in the hospital...
that's a point.
She has kind of decided that it's either this or nothing.
Well, it's like history repeating itself.
She's got to make the best of a bad situation.
Well, she's settling for Hank in the way that Ed settled for Norma, kind of back in the... Nadine.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day.
Yeah.
And he mentions Ed again to her, you know, like, oh, could you get him to? And he seems to have this little... kind of morbid, he likes bringing up Ed almost, I think, to gauge her responses.
Her reaction, yeah.
We see the traffic light, which we haven't seen for a while, at night. And usually what that signifies is that we're about to move into one of those kind of liminal spaces that we talked about before.
Yeah.
And the next scene is inside Harold's house. And I almost feel like Harold's house is one of those liminal spaces.
Remind me again what a liminal space is.
It's a sort of area that feels like it's a gateway to somewhere else.
Right.
So, for example, photographers take photographs of places that are meant to be liminal spaces. And often there'll be things like indoor swimming baths at night, where it looks like if you just walk into the darkness, you might... The wardrobe in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is a great example of a liminal space. But some places just give that off. Some spaces just look like the crack in the mountain in Return of the King, where the ghost people are behind. You know, there are some places that when you look at them, and it's something that's hard to articulate.
It's taking you to another world.
Yeah, yeah. It's like... the liminal spaces, there's a Twitter account that I follow. It's photography. And it's funny because all the images are completely different things and nothing links them. But when you look at enough of them, you start to get what it means. You're like, yeah, there are some spaces that look like somewhere that are that is just a crossing into another place.
Yeah.
And Harold's house has that energy a little bit. I think maybe because of his association with the grandmother and the magician boy.
And maybe like the use of plants and stuff, because it has that sort of alive in a different way.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And there's other places as well that do, like the roadhouse sometimes feels like that. You know, they've got the red
curtains.
Well,
when they have the spotlight that comes down at various times.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It almost feels like there's certain areas in Twin Peaks where the veil between worlds is thinner. And it definitely, and I think.
I remember you explaining it before. It's just completely gone out of my brain.
No, well, I mean, it is kind of an abstract thing, but I'm saying this to the listeners as much as anyone else, do a Google Images search for liminal spaces, and they all just look like Lynchian things. Mm. And there's a lot more to come of those as we move through. But and I think the placement of the insert of the traffic light is definitely part of that. Mm. I love the way that Donna and Harold are having like a sophisticated Meals on Wheels meal. Like they're drinking wine, but you can see like the metal lid thing on the floor and all
some like really manky looking casserole.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, like I mentioned last time, I think part of the appeal for Harold, of Harold to Donna is not only that she's just, you know, pissed off with James and that he has perhaps insight into Laura's world, but the fact that he does represent this slightly more grown-up world, although he is a shut-in.
I did notice the glass of wine in his hand
this
time.
It was white this week, though. He
paid particular attention to see, yes, he does have wine in his hand.
Yeah, oh, good, I'm glad. And he reads from the diary as well. And it's I love the way that like he talks about he's read it several times. He's like, oh, but I accidentally read a wildly inappropriate part of that.
I know. I was thinking when he read that out, wouldn't you like pre-read a couple of things?
Yeah.
Like, it's like pick a passage that's going to be
that's,
kind
it's
of
like
okay.
Your mum walking in during the wrong scene in a movie or something, isn't it? But I mean, it's useful for us as the audience to know though, because it speaks more about this kind of self-loathing, this sense of worthlessness that Laura had as well, this sort of darkness. And Harold tells Donna about how people come to him to tell him their stories. And we see Josie return as well. And I think this is another one of the reasons why this feels very, very TV, is that there's lots of short scenes, which is not something that you associate with Twin Peaks. We see more stuff with Audrey being brought to Jean, and he kills Emery Battis for sort of manhandling her as well.
I mean, she must be really regretting trying to be a detective.
Yeah, it's not panning out.
It's really not.
For her at all, is it?
Yeah.
Although I've got to say, she still looks great. Even like considering she's all smacked out.
Smacked out. When's the last time she had a shower?
Yeah, exactly. It's again, TV logic.
It has only been, what?
2 days or something.
A day or two, yeah.
We see Cooper talk to Lucy about Andy, and I love the way everybody's like, you know, so does he know about this dick? It's like the perfect naming of a character here. We see Cooper talk to Truman about needing a bookhouse boy. I think it's funny, when we go back to the diner and they're getting all excited about the travel writer, we're introduced to Toad, who is the classic, like, Norm kind of character. Like, he recurs. He's in a bit unlike Morn in Deep Space Nine.
I was just about to say Morn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the obese kind of, like, right down to, like, comically obese. Like, when he's in the kitchen, he's, like, eating the soup and just like he just can't stop eating because he's a fat man. You know, it's that, that's the kind. That's what we're being told about this character here. And we see Maddie and Donna meet, and obviously, you know, Donna is a little pissed off. Seriously
cheesed off.
Yeah. And she talks about how.
But Carol, Maddie is also kind of like so ready to call bullshit on her, on the hypocrisy of Donna, you know, all pissed off about James supposedly having something going on with Maddie.
Yeah.
She's
not contrite at all, is she, Maddie? She looks like she looks a bit.
She's just like, there's nothing going on. We had a hug.
Yeah.
I mean, she likes James.
Yeah.
But Donna's doing her own thing anyway.
The thing about James is, you know, he really feels, doesn't he?
Oh,
you know?
God.
And it's intoxicating. You know, he's just.
Why is life so hard for James?
Yeah.
Poor James.
It's just, he's just a poet. What can I say?
And he knows it.
I know he knows it.
And you know it.
I love the way that when Donna says to Maddie about how Harold's got Laura's diary and Maddie's like, well, didn't the police find it? She's like, no, she's got like a second secret diary. Mm. I think of the episode of Psych, you know, the one that was a Twin Peaks parody.
Yeah.
When it's just like, what is it with all you people and your secrets? He's like, what is it with this town and secrets? It's like, it's one of those moments. She's like, and you can see Maddie like a second a secret diary, like a double secret probation. What the hell? We see Harry goes to see Josie, but she sort of vajazzles him out of vaginatizes him.
Rip it.
Exactly. Because he's just like, look, come on.
He just sort of goes, oh, fuck it.
Yeah, he's like, you know, after we've had rough sex, I've got some serious questions to ask you. We see the mystery Asian man at the window that we saw in the early episode. We're introduced to Judge Sternbach, is that his name? But the reason I want to mention him is the actor who plays him. This is another one of those great old Hollywood Twin Peaks castings, you know, like people like, you know, Richard Beamer and Russ Tamblyn, you know, obviously both in West Side Story together and in lots of films. And Russ Tamblyn was, you know, in lots of great Hollywood films like The Haunting and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. A lot of the great musicals. But Roald Dahl was, I mean, this is a guy who was like, I mean, he's been working, he was originally cast in to play the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, wow.
He ended up, there's loads of footage of the screen test of him in the makeup, but he had an allergy to the silver paint and got sick and ended up in hospital and they replaced him. But I mean, that shows you how long that guy's been working in Hollywood.
Yeah.
He was like, you know, was in The Wizard of Oz for like a week. Mm. And he's somebody who's hired not because he's well known, but because he's just got that presence. And I think that this is what Tarantino understood. People talk about Tarantino resurrecting careers and stunt casting, but it's not. He just knows that there's lots of really good people out there, people like Robert Forster and, you know, Pam Grier and people who are amazing actors who we haven't seen in a million things, unless you're a movie nerd who's watched like a lot of exploitation films. Mm. And you've got actors like, you know, Richard Beamer and, you know, Roald Dahl in this case, who are just incredible film and television and stage actors and can just deliver dialogue and just, you know, bring presence and movie star quality.
And watching them do it is just such a joy.
Yeah. Yeah, and acting styles change, you know. But seeing, you know, somebody with just that cadence is always just a real treat.
Yeah.
There's some of the weird gender stuff that you get in the early 90s. Like he looks at Truman and says, oh, it looks like you've got Philly trouble. but they do deconstruct it a little bit. He's just kind of like, you know, when you can't get a saddle on him, he's like, there's only two things you can do. And then he stops. He's like, but I'm not going to bore you with either of them. So it does kind of deflect it.
Yeah.
But Twin Peaks does have this, and I think part of it is that one of the things that Twin Peaks kind of, parodies is probably too strong a word, but references as well as a soap opera, is cop movies and cop dramas and buddy things. And one of those is the whole kind of women, You know, can't live with them, can't kill them. You know, that kind of eye-rolling kind of. And Twin Peaks is occasionally guilty of that a little bit.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of that here, a bit of kind of, you know, oh, gosh, what a pain, eh?
Fucking females.
Yeah, exactly. And then we get the scene with Lucy and Dick. And he's talking about how, you know, I'm going to do the right thing. And basically he's paying her off to have an abortion.
Yeah.
But I love the way she responds. She's very calm. She's like, okay, this is what's going to happen. You know, and she explains that she's...
I love that she had to detail the out-of-door sticks.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, helpful to the last. And this is where we get that really nice scene with Leland and the judge as well. And, you know, I've got the note here about how it's a lot like Briggs, where it's people who do jobs that are quite functional and civic, but kind of have the heart of poets as well. Yeah. And I love the way that that's Leland as well. Leland is obviously a man of the arts as well. Yeah. And he loved the way that at the end of it, when he's like, you know, before, because the judge is like, before we take our roles in this enduring drama, you know, was it, we'll
meet again. Valhalla.
Yeah, we'll raise a glass in Valhalla. And I love the way that Leland's like, you know, would that it were so.
Yeah.
You know? It's a very literary kind of way of doing that. Because, of course, they know each other because he's a judge. He was a judge.
He was a lawyer.
He was an incestuous demon.
Oh, Leland.
We see...
Come the... and knock at our door.
We get another instance of the weird thing of the week in the Great Northern with the, is it the Lumber Queens? Or where you see all of the girls.
Well, there's another pretty misogynistic bit with the slightly plump girl at the end running through and Ben sort of shaking sneering, his head. At her. Yeah.
We
and
see,
just say for all chunky women everywhere, fuck you, Ben.
We see middle-aged a middle-aged Asian man looking at Ben mysteriously. We see Josie's cousin talking to her, saying that her job is done and that she, well, that they need Pete's signature before they return to Thomas Eckert in Hong Kong, or Zong Kong, as I've written here in my notes.
Zong Kong.
Yep. We see Harry at the roadhouse, and it's a nice moment. I wanted to see the rest of that scene. I wanted to see Harry and Cooper just having a beer,
yeah,
you know, loosening the ties a little bit. And I love the way as well that he's like, let me buy you a beer. Bartender, whenever I see somebody do that in a film, I always think of Chandler on his date. Is he, young man? And the girl turns around. Anytime I see somebody call for a bartender in a film or television, I always think of Chandler on that awkward date with Janice in the first season of Friends. But we learn, of course, that Truman is the bookhouse boy that's coming along for the clandestine rescue. Not that he knows that yet, of Audrey from One Eye Jacks. We see Hank in the diner at night, and the cousin appears, and he gets sort of retribution for Hank's cutting of the fingernail. Yeah. What he should have done, he's got loads of dominoes, just forced them into his mouth. Like, if you wanted to go for like
suck a on these.
Or like a giant comedy domino. And be like, hey, you like dominoes? And then the next episode is just Hank waking up going, and then he just twatted me with a bloody great pomelo. It's the weirdest thing, and, you know. But no, what we see is that he echoes the forced blood brothering that Hank bestowed upon Josie in an earlier episode. And then the episode ends. Any final thoughts, Hannah, before we wrap up?
I thoroughly enjoyed this and really, really enjoyed the performances from, you know, several of the characters. It was just a joy to watch.
Yeah, and I think it says a lot about the, and this is a term I used a lot when we covered Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because that was a show that, you know, would, like any show, particularly ones that have longer seasons. And it's worth mentioning, of course, that, you know, this season of Twin Peaks is substantially longer than the first. So the likelihood of them running into those, just those practical problems that you have when you're just trying to generate this amount of content, is, you know, things like difficulties with writers, actors not being available, all of those things that happen. I mentioned on with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that it says a lot about the infrastructure, the sort of the creative infrastructure of the show, as far as it having good bones, you know, like the cast, the writers, the sense of its identity and all of those things that mean that when you do have just shit happening, like what was going on when they were creating this episode, that they still managed to make a pretty solid episode with two or three extremely memorable moments in it. It's a good one. What are you talking about next time, Anna?
Okay, next time we have The Orchid's Curse, episode 5. Cooper remembers the message under his bed. Shelley and Bobby begin Leo's home care. Sternwood hears pre-trial motions and declares Leo not fit for trial. Nadine comes home still thinking she's in high school.
Stern would not stand back. Wow, so a lot of those characters that we talked about not being present in this week are returning. And I think that's another symptom of a longer season, is that you don't have to service every character every episode, because you're not only doing 7 of them. You know, you're doing a whole like 22 or whatever it is.
This episode is directed by Graham Clifford.
Yeah.
And written by Barry Pullman.
Ah, cool.
So I'm looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. Quick reminder that we do appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. Alternatively, you can leave us messages or comments on our YouTube channel. And we also would like you to check out our friend shows and appreciate reviews over at Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And if you want to reach out to us on social media, you can do that on Instagram and Twitter, where in both cases we are at RewatchProj. That's Rewatch, P-R-O-J. So that is us for now, and we will see you soon.
Bye-bye. Take care, everyone.